tears and decided to keep things dark. No one knew she was there, and lights would only attract attention. At the same time, she wanted to give the house the full white-gloved inspection to see what Nineveh had been up to. Were the dishes all washed and stacked neatly where they belonged? Was there a layer of dust on the coffee tables? What had been done to Pete's things? The clothes in his closet, the books and papers in his study? She could vaguely recall a conversation with Joel about this, but the details were gone. She eased into the den and fell into the soft leather sofa, which felt and smelled just the way she remembered. Her first memory of the sofa was perhaps the worst. Joel to her right, Stella to her left, all three staring in utter fear at the army captain as he delivered the news that Pete was missing and presumed dead. May 19th, 1942. Another lifetime. Headlights swept through the windows and startled her. She peeked through the curtains and watched as a Ford County patrol car crept along her drive, then turned onto the side road that led to Florey's. It disappeared, and she knew they were looking for her. She waited, and 20 minutes later the car came into view, passed the house again, and headed to the highway. She reminded herself that she was sitting in her own home, and she had committed no crime. If they found her, the worst they could do was send her back to Whitfield. They would not get the chance. She began rocking, her shoulders jerking back and forth, a tedious habit that often afflicted her and she couldn't control. When she worried or was afraid, she began rocking and humming and twitching her hair. A lot of the crazy people at Whitfield engaged in all manner of rocking and twitching and groaning as they sat alone in the cafeteria or by the pond. But she always knew she would not be like them. She would get fixed, and soon, and pull her life back together. After an hour or so, she had lost all concept of time. She realized that she was no longer rocking. And the crying had stopped too. There were so many burdens to unload. She walked to the kitchen, to the only phone, and called Florey. To confound the eavesdroppers, she said, "Florey, I'm here." "Who? What?" Florey was startled, and rightfully so. "I'm at the house," Liza said, and hung up. She walked to the back porch and waited. Only a few minutes passed before she saw headlights bouncing across the landscape. Florey parked beside the house.
"Over here, Florey," Liza said. "On the porch."
Florey walked to the rear, almost stumbling in the dark, and said,
"Why don't you turn on some damn lights around here?"
She stopped at the steps, looked up at Liza, and asked,
"What the hell are you doing, Liza?" "Come give me a hug, Florey."
Well, she must be crazy if she wants a hug from me, Florey thought, but certainly didn't say. She climbed the steps, and they embraced. Florey said,
"Again, I'll ask, what are you doing here?" "Just wanted to come home. The doctor said it was fine."
"That's a lie, and you know it. The doctors are worried. The kids are beside themselves. The police are looking for you. Why'd you pull a stunt like this?"
"Got tired of Whitfield. Let's go inside."
They entered the kitchen, and Florey said,
"Hit the lights. I can't see a damn thing."
"I like it dark, Florey. Besides, I don't want Nineveh to know I'm here."
Florey found a switch and turned on the kitchen lights. She had visited Liza at Whitfield, and like Stella and Joel, had always been troubled by her appearance. She had improved a little, but she was still painfully thin, gaunt, hollow. You look good, Liza. It's nice to see you.
Nice to be home.
Now we need to call Joel and let him know you're safe, okay?
I just talked to him. He'll be here in an hour.
Florrie relaxed and said,
Good. Have you eaten? You look hungry.
I don't eat much, Florrie. Let's go sit in the den and talk.
Whatever you want, dear. She would pacify her until Joel arrived, and then they would decide what to do.
Shouldn't we call your doctors?
Florrie asked.
They need to know you're okay.
I told Joel to call them. He'll take care of it. Everything is fine, Florrie.
They walked into the den, and Liza turned the switch on a small lamp. A faint light gave the room an eerie, shadowy feel. Florrie wanted more light, but said nothing. She took one end of the sofa. Liza propped pillows on the other and reclined on them. They faced each other in the semi-darkness.
Would you like some coffee?
Liza asked.
Not really.
Me neither.
I've almost stopped drinking it. The caffeine doesn't sit well with all the pills I take, and it gives me headaches. You wouldn't believe the drugs they try to stuff into me. Sometimes I take them, sometimes I don't swallow and spit them out.
Why haven't you been to see me more often, Florrie?
I don't know. It's a long trip down there, and it's not exactly an uplifting place to visit.
Uplifting? You expect to be uplifted when you visit the Nut House?
It's not about you, Florrie. It's about me, the patient, the crazy woman. I'm the sick one, and you're supposed to visit me and show some support.
The two had never been close, and Florrie remembered why. However, at the moment she was willing to take some shots, if that would help. Hopefully they'd come get her tomorrow and take her back.
Are we going to bicker, Liza?
Haven't we always?
No. We did at first. And then we realized that the best way to get along was to give each other plenty of room. That's what I remember, Liza. We've always been cautiously friendly for the sake of the family.
If you say so. I want you to tell me a story, Florrie. One that I've never heard.
Maybe. I want to hear your version of what happened the day Pete killed Dexter Bell.
I know you probably don't want to talk about it, but everyone knows it all. Everyone but me. For a long time, they wouldn't tell me anything down there. I guess they figured it would just make bad matters worse. And they were right, because when they finally told me, I went into a coma for a week and almost died. But anyway, I'd like to hear your version.
Why, Liza? It's not a good story.
Why?
Because it's a pretty damned important part of my life. Don't you think, Florrie? My husband kills our preacher and gets executed for it, and I don't know the details.
Come on, Florrie. I have a right to know. Tell me the story.
Florrie shrugged, and the story flowed. One led to the next. Life at the jail, the hearings in court, the reactions around town, the reports in the newspapers, the trial, the execution, the burial, the veterans who still stopped by the grave. At times, Liza cried and wiped her face with the back of her hands. At times, she listened with her eyes closed, as if absorbing the horrors. She moaned occasionally and rocked a little. She asked a few questions, made only a couple of comments.
You know, he came to see me the day before they killed him.
Yes, I remember that.
He said he still loved me, but that he could never forgive me. How about that, Florrie? A lot of love, but not enough for forgiveness.
facing a certain death, he still could not forgive me.
Forgive what?
And with that, Florrie managed to ask the great question. Liza closed her eyes and leaned her head on a pillow. Her lips were moving as if she were mumbling something only she could understand. Then she was completely still and silent. Softly, Florrie repeated,
"Forgive what, Liza? We have so much to talk about, Florrie, and I want to do it now, because I'm not going to live much longer. Something is wrong with me, Florrie, and not just the crazy stuff. There's a disease deep in my body, and it's getting worse. Might be cancer, might be something else, but I know it's there, and it's growing. The doctors can't find it, but I know it's there. They can give me drugs that soothe the nervous breakdown, but they have nothing for my disease. I don't know what to say, Liza."
"Say nothing. Just listen."
Hours had passed. Hours with no sign of Joel. Liza seemed to forget about him, but Florrie was well aware that he should have been there. Liza stood and said,
"I think I'll change clothes, Florrie. I've been thinking about a certain pair of linen pajamas and a silk bathrobe that Pete always loved."
She walked to their bedroom door as Florrie stood and stretched her legs. Florrie went to the kitchen and poured a glass of water. A wall clock gave the time as 11:40. She took the phone to call Joel, and then she saw the problem. The wire running from the baseboard to the phone had been cut, snipped cleanly in two as if by scissors. The phone was useless, and it had probably not been used that night to call Joel. She returned to the den and waited. Liza was in her bedroom with the door open, and she was crying, louder and louder. She was lying on the bed she had shared with Pete, wearing the white linen pajamas under a cream silk bathrobe. Her feet were bare. Florrie leaned over her and said,
"It's okay, Liza. I'm here with you. What's wrong, honey?"
Liza pointed to a chair and said,
"Please."
She wiped her face with a tissue and struggled to get control. Florrie took a seat and waited. Liza had not called Joel. Joel had not called the doctors, nor Stella. They were all waiting frantically for news from somewhere. And here was Liza on her bed in her home. Florrie wanted to ask why she had cut the phone line, but that conversation would go nowhere. Liza was on the verge of talking and perhaps revealing secrets that they thought would never be revealed. Best not to distract her. She didn't want Joel around at this moment. Liza finally asked,
"Did Pete talk to you before he died?"
"Of course. We discussed a lot of things, the kids, the farm, the usual things you might expect a dying person to cover."
"Did he talk about us and our troubles?"
"Indeed he did. But Florrie wasn't taking the bait. She wanted to hear it all from the closest source."
"Of course not. You know how private he was." "What kinds of troubles?" "Oh, Florrie, there are so many secrets, so many sins. I really can't blame Pete for not forgiving me."
She began crying again, then sobbing. The outburst became something of a wail, a loud, aching, agonized groan that startled Florrie. She had never heard such painful mourning. Liza's body retched as if she might vomit violently. Then she heaved and convulsed as she sobbed uncontrollably. It went on and on,
and finally Flory could watch no longer. She went to the bed, lay down beside her, and clutched her tightly. "It's okay, Liza. It's okay, honey. You're okay." Flory hugged and whispered and cooed and promised and patted her softly. And she rocked her and whispered some more. And Liza began to relax. She breathed easier, seemed to withdraw into her own little emaciated body, and cried gently. In a whisper, she said,
"There are some things you should know."
"I'm listening, Liza. I'm here." She awoke in a dark room under the covers, the door open. The house was dark, the only light from the small lamp in the den. Liza quietly shoved back the covers, got to her feet, and walked out of her bedroom. Flory was on the sofa under a quilt, dead to the world. Without a sound, Liza walked by her and into the kitchen, through the door, across the porch, down the steps. The air was cold. Her feet were bare and soon wet. She glided through the grass and onto the footpath that led to the barns, her silk bathrobe flowing behind her. The moon came and went between the clouds, with its bluish light washing over the outbuildings and the fields before disappearing again. She knew where she was going and didn't need the light. When she passed the last barn, she saw the silhouettes of her horses in a paddock. She had never passed by without speaking to them. But she had nothing to say. Her feet were wet, muddy, and frozen. But she did not care. Pain was of little consequence now. She shivered in the cold and walked with a purpose. Up the slight rise to Old Sycamore. And she was soon among the dead. All those dead Bannings she had heard so much about. The moon was hidden, and she could not read the names on the tombstones. But she knew where he was buried, because she knew where the other ones were. She pressed her fingers to the limestone and traced his name. She had found her husband. Though overwhelmed with grief, guilt, and shame, she was tired of crying. She was frozen and praying for the end. They say people are at peace when they reach this point. They lie. She felt no peace, no sense of comfort, no belief that what she was doing would ever be considered anything other than a desperate act of a crazy woman. She eased down and sat with her back against his headstone, as close as she could possibly get. His body was just a few feet below hers. She told him she loved him and would see him soon, and prayed that when they were together again, he could finally forgive her. From a pocket in her bathrobe, she removed a small bottle of pills. Chapter 47. Amos found her at daybreak, and when he got close enough to the tombstones to make sure he saw what he thought he saw, he broke and ran back to the house, yelling and running faster than he had in decades. When Flory heard that she was dead, she fainted on the back porch. When she came to, Nineveh helped her to the sofa and tried to console her. Nix Gridley and Roy Lester arrived to help with the search, and when Amos described what he had found in the cemetery, they left him behind and drove to it. The empty pill bottle was sufficient evidence. There was no crime scene to bother with. A misty rain was falling, and Nix decided that she should not get wet. He and Lester loaded Liza into the rear seat and returned to the house. Nix went inside to deal with the family while Lester drove her to the funeral home. Around 5 a.m., Flory had awakened and realized Liza was gone. She panicked and ran to Nineveh's house, where Amos had just started breakfast. He and Nineveh searched frantically around the house and barns while Flory drove to the Pink Cottage to use the phone. She called Joel and Dr. Hilzebeck and briefly described the situation. Joel was en route from Oxford when he passed the sheriff's car leaving his home. Once inside, he heard the rest of the story. Flory was a mess, blaming herself relentlessly and gasping for breath. After Joel finally talked to Stella by phone, he insisted his aunt ride with him to the hospital. She was admitted with chest pains and subdued with tranquilizers. He left her there and went to the sheriff's office to use Nix's phone on a private line. He talked to Dr. Hilzebeck, who was distraught. He forced himself to call Gran and Papa Sweeney in Kansas City with the news that their daughter was dead. He called Stella again, and they tried to think through the next few days. He left the sheriff's office and drove to McGargle's funeral home. In a cold, dark room somewhere in the rear of the building, he looked at his mother's beautiful face for the last time and selected a casket. He made it back to his car before he broke down. Sitting in the parking lot, staring at nothing as the wipers clicked back and forth, Joel was thoroughly overwhelmed by grief and cried for a long time. The service was at the Methodist Church, the one built by Pete's grandfather, the one in which Joel and Stella were baptized as children. The minister was new and freshly rotated into town by the Methodist hierarchy. He knew the history, but had not lived through it, and he was determined to reunite the factions and heal his congregation. At first, Joel and Stella planned a private burial, one similar to the quick send-off Pete had planned for himself at Old Sycamore. But friends convinced them that their mother deserved a proper funeral. They relented and met with the minister. The crowd was huge, twice the size of all available seating, and people sat in their cars in the parking lot and waited for a glimpse of the casket. The friends and acquaintances who had been denied the chance to say goodbye to Pete made sure they arrived early for Liza's farewell. Mr. and Mrs. Sweeney sat between Joel and Stella and stared at the closed casket 5 feet away. Mrs. Sweeney was inconsolable and never stopped wiping her face. Mr. Sweeney was stoic, almost angry, as if he blamed the entire backward state for his daughter's demise. Joel and Stella were tired of crying and sat stunned, disbelieving, desperately waiting for the hour to pass. The occasion was too somber for any effort at levity. There were no warm eulogies of good and funny times with the deceased. No mention of Pete, not in that church. The Bannings' nightmare was continuing, and those watching it were helpless to intervene. A few hymns, a brief sermon, some scripture, and it was over in less than an hour, as promised by the minister. As Miss Emma Faye Riddle began her last mournful number, the congregation rose, and the closed casket was pushed down the center aisle, followed by Joel and Stella, arm in arm. Behind them, Mr. and Mrs. Sweeney held each other and tried to keep themselves together. Behind them were other members of the Sweeney family, but no Bannings. Flory was at home in bed. The rest of the small family was rapidly dying off. Of course, none of the coloreds were allowed inside the church. as Joel trailed the casket, and the organ played, and the ladies cried. He was aware of the many stares. Near the rear, he glanced to his right, and in the back row was the prettiest face he had ever seen. Marianne Maloof had made the trip from Oxford with a sorority sister to pay her respects. Seeing her was the only pleasant moment of the day. Stepping into the vestibule, he told himself that one day he would marry that girl. An hour later, a small crowd gathered at Old Sycamore for the interment. Just the family, a few friends, Amos and Nineveh, Marietta, and a dozen other Negroes who lived on the land. Florrie insisted on being there, but Joel insisted that she remain in the pink cottage. Joel was very much in charge now, making decisions that he had no desire to make. After a prayer, some scripture, and the same haunting rendition of Amazing Grace by Marietta, four men lowered Liza's casket into the ground, less than a foot from the one holding the remains of her husband. Side by side, they could now rest together for eternity. She was as responsible for his death as he was for hers. Above them, they left behind two fine children who didn't deserve to be punished for the sins of their parents. The week after the funeral was Thanksgiving. Joel sorely needed to return to law school and start cramming for finals, though as a third-year student, he was coasting with a much easier schedule. On Monday, he and Stella drove to Oxford. He met with the dean and laid it all on the table. Some rather complicated family matters had to be dealt with, and he needed to be excused for a few more days. The dean knew what was happening, was sympathetic, and promised arrangements could be made. Joel was in the top 10% of his class and would graduate the following May. While in Oxford, Joel invited Marianne to lunch at the mansion to meet his sister. Driving over, he had admitted to Stella his feelings for the girl, and Stella was delighted her brother was finally involved in a serious romance. Since their mother's breakdown and the death of their father, the two had talked more and more openly. They leaned on each other and held back little. As Bannings, they had been raised to say almost nothing, but those days were gone. There had always been too many secrets in the family. The two young ladies were immediate friends. In fact, they bonded so quickly and talked and laughed so much that Joel was astonished. He said little during lunch because he hardly got the chance. Driving home, Stella told him he'd better get a ring on her finger before someone else did. Joel said he wasn't worried. The lunch lifted their somber spirits, but by the time they crossed into Ford County, they were thinking about their mother again, and the conversation died. When Joel turned into the drive, he inched along the gravel and stopped halfway to the house. He turned off the motor, and they looked at their home. Stella finally spoke.
"I never thought I would say this, but I really don't like this place now. The happy memories are all gone, shattered by what's happened. I never want to set foot in that house again."
"I think we should burn it," Joel said.
"Don't be stupid. Are you serious?"
"Sort of. I can't stomach the idea of Jackie Bell and her kids and that creep McLeish living here. He'll become the gentleman farmer, a real big shot."
"That's hard to swallow. But you're never going to live here again, right, Joel?"
"Right."
"Nor am I. So what difference does it make? We'll come back when we have to and visit Florrie. But after she's gone, I'll never come back."
"What about the cemetery?"
"What about it? How are we supposed to benefit from staring at old tombstones and wiping tears? the dead. And it's painful because they shouldn't be dead. But they're gone, Joel. I'm trying to forget how they died and remember how they lived. Let's remember the good times, if that's possible.
It seems impossible now.
Yes, it does.
It's all moot, Stella. We're losing the place anyway.
I know. Just sign the deed and get it over with. I'm going back to the big city.
The headmistress at St. Agnes was sympathetic, too, and told Stella she would be excused for the week. She was expected back the Sunday after Thanksgiving. They stayed in the pink cottage and away from their house. Marietta roasted a turkey and prepared all the side dishes and pies, and they worked hard to get through the day in a grateful spirit. Flory was rallying and trying to enjoy the time with them. Early Friday morning, Joel loaded Stella's bags into the Pontiac, and they hugged their aunt goodbye. They stopped at Old Sycamore and had a tear. At their house, Stella hurried inside for a hug with Nineveh. Then they were off. She had insisted on taking the train to D.C., but Joel would have none of it. She was quite fragile, weren't they all? And he did not want her sitting alone on a train for hour after hour. They needed the time together, so a road trip was in order. As they left the farm and turned onto the highway, Stella looked at her home and the fields around them. She hoped to never return, and she never would. Dead judges were replaced by the governor, who appointed interims until the next round of elections. Governor Fielding Wright, who had witnessed Pete's execution 2.5 years earlier, was flooded with the usual requests for patronage after the death of Chancellor Rumbold. One of Wright's biggest supporters in North Mississippi was none other than Birch Dunlap, who was lobbying hard for a Tupelo sidekick named Jack Chenault. Dunlap had a plan to collect a quick, lucrative fee from the Banning case, and he needed Chenault on the bench. In early December, while Joel was sweating through final exams at Ole Miss, Governor Wright appointed Chenault, the interim chancellor, to succeed Rumbold. John Wilbanks and most of the other lawyers disliked the choice, primarily because Chenault did not live in the district. He said he planned to move. Wilbanks was pushing another candidate, but Wilbanks and Governor Wright had never been on the same team. Out of respect for the family, Dunlap waited a month after Liza's burial before swinging into action. He convinced Chenault to convene a meeting in Clanton with John Wilbanks and Joel Banning, who was home for the holiday break and had been appointed substitute trustee for his father's estate. They met in the judge's chamber behind the courtroom, a place Joel would always detest. On the docket was Dunlap's lawsuit seeking a judicial foreclosure of the land now held by Pete Banning's estate, the last remaining salvo in the lengthy war over the property. And it was readily apparent that the new chancellor planned to move with haste. By reputation, Chenault was an office practitioner and not a trial lawyer, and was generally well thought of. He was certainly prepared for the meeting, and John Wilbanks suspected he had been well rehearsed by Birch Dunlap. According to his honor, and Chenault even wore a black robe for the occasion, the scenario was straightforward. The hearing on the foreclosure would last only an hour or so, with both sides submitting documents and court orders, and perhaps a witness or two, but there was almost nothing disputed. He, Chenault, would most likely order a judicial sale of the property, which entailed an auction on the front steps of the courthouse. The highest bidder would take title, with the winning bid going straight to Jackie Bell, who held the judgment of $100,000. No one expected a bid that high, and any deficit would remain on the books as a lien against the property. However, according to Mr. Dunlap,
The plaintiff, Jackie Bell, was willing to accept a deed from the estate for the acreage, the house, and other assets in lieu of her claim. Also, if Chenault ruled in favor of Jackie Bell, as he obviously planned to do, the Banning estate could appeal to the Mississippi Supreme Court, a delaying tactic that had been used before. Such an appeal would be fruitless, in his opinion. Joel knew it too, as did John Wilbanks. They were at the end of the road. Additional delaying strategies would only postpone the inevitable and drive up the attorney's fees. With everyone in general agreement, Chenault allowed the lawyers 30 days to work out the details and scheduled the next meeting on January 26, 1950. In the spirit of the season, and with the promise of a brighter future, Jackie Bell and Errol MacLeish were married in a small ceremony 2 days before Christmas. Her three children were dressed up and proud, and a few friends joined them in the small chapel behind an Episcopal church. Her parents were not invited. They did not approve of the marriage because they did not trust Errol MacLeish and his motives. Her father had insisted that she consult with a lawyer before the marriage, but she refused. MacLeish was far too involved with her lawsuits and her money, and she was certainly being set up for financial disaster, according to her father. And she was not attending church, which greatly disturbed her parents. She had tried to explain her crisis of faith, but they would not listen. One was either in church or not, and those on the outside faced damnation. Jackie was thrilled with the plan to leave Rome and return to Clanton. She needed space from her parents, and more important, she was eager to assume ownership of the Banning home. She had been there many times and never dreamed it would one day belong to her. After a life in cramped parsonages and rentals, a life where every house was too small and too temporary, she, Jackie Bell, was about to own one of the finest homes in Ford County. Chapter 48. On a freezing morning 2 days after Christmas, Joel was walking through the fields after a visit to Old Sycamore. Pellets began landing around him. It was sleeting, and there was a good chance of snow by late afternoon. He hustled to the house and was about to suggest a road trip somewhere to the south when Aunt Florrie announced that she had decided to spend a couple of months in New Orleans as the house guest of Miss Twyla. She had been hinting about leaving. She was depressed about everything, Liza's death and her involvement in it, the cold weather, the dreary fields and landscapes, and of course, the handing over of Pete's land, which she had to cross to get to hers. There were dark clouds everywhere, and she just wanted to get away. They left within an hour, as road conditions deteriorated and barely made it south through Polk County before the sleet slacked off. By Jackson, the weather and roads were better. Along the way, they covered many important topics. Joel planned to propose to Marianne later in the spring. He had bought an engagement ring in Memphis and was excited about giving it to her. He was determined to live in Biloxi and thought he had a job with a small law firm there. Nothing definite, but he was optimistic. They worried about Stella and her nagging depression. She was spending the holidays with friends in D.C., and could not force herself to come home. Wasn't the whole family depressed? The most urgent matter was what to do with Florrie's land in the upcoming spring. Neither had the stomach to approach MacLeish about a deal. Indeed, Florrie wanted to be absent for the next few months to avoid the man. They finally decided that Joel would negotiate a lease with Doug Wilbanks, John's cousin. He farmed thousands of acres in several counties and would not be intimidated by MacLeish. They were not sure what would happen to the Negroes on the property, but those poor folks had always managed to survive. MacLeish would need them as field hands. No one would starve. And they couldn't worry about everybody, could they? Their lives had changed dramatically since the killing, and there was no way to recapture the past. They had to take care of themselves. Flory admitted that for the past 2 years, she had been talking about living for a spell in New Orleans with Miss Twyla, a dear old friend from the Memphis years. Twyla was older and getting lonelier, and her rambling townhouse in the quarter had plenty of room. They talked for hours, always about the present or the future, and not about the past. But south of Jackson, some 4 hours into the journey, Joel said, "Stella and I believe you know a lot more than you've ever told us."
"About what?"
"About Pete and Dexter, about Mom, about what happened." "You know something, don't you, Aunt Flory?"
"Why is this important now? Everybody's dead."
"The night Dad died, you went to see him at the jail."
"What did you talk about?"
"Must we rehash this? That was one of the worst nights of my life."
"Typical Banning response, Aunt Flory. Take the question, duck it, and try to wiggle away without a response.
Where did you and Pete learn to be so evasive?"
"Don't be insulting, Joel."
"I'm not. Just answer the question."
"What do you want to know?"
"Why did Dad kill Dexter?"
"He never gave me a reason, and believe me, I pressed him hard. He was a very stubborn man."
"No kidding. I figure Mom had an affair with Dexter Bell, and somehow Dad found out about it when he got home from the war. He confronted her, and she was overwhelmed with guilt and shame. She cracked up or whatever, and he wanted her out of the house. Wilbanks convinced Judge Rumbold she needed some time away, and Dad drove her to Whitfield. After that, Dad could never accept the fact that his wife had been unfaithful, especially given the nightmare he survived in the war.
Think about it, Aunt Flory.
He was over there starved nearly to death, wiped out with malaria and dysentery, getting tortured and abused, then fighting in the jungles, and she's home sleeping with the preacher. It drove him crazy, and that's why he killed Dexter Bell. Something snapped in Pete's mind."
"Your response, Aunt Flory?"
"You think your father cracked up?"
"Yes. And you don't?"
"No.
I think Pete knew exactly what he was doing.
He was not crazy.
I'll buy the rest of your story, but Pete was thinking clearly."
"And he never told you this story?" She took a deep breath and glanced out her window. The pause gave the real answer, but she did not.
"No, not a word."
Joel knew she was lying. There was no chance of snow in New Orleans. The temperature was in the 50s, the air clear and crisp. Miss Twyla greeted them with a flurry of fierce hugs and loud hellos and served them drinks as her maid unloaded the car. Flory brought enough luggage, all hastily packed, to stay for a year. Joel mentioned possibly getting a room at the Hotel Monteleone on Royal Street, but Twyla would have none of it. Her elegant townhouse had plenty of bedrooms, and she needed some company. They sat in the courtyard next to an old fountain with water dripping from a cement tiger and talked about this and that. As soon as Flory excused herself for a moment, Twyla whispered to Joel,
"She looks awful."
"It's been a rough time. She's blaming herself for my mom's death. I'm so sorry about that, Joel."
"Flory was hospitalized, right?"
"Yes, for a few days. Chest pains. I worry about her.
She looks pale and thinner."
"Well, I guess she needs some gumbo and jambalaya and fried oysters. I've hauled her down here. Now you feed her."
"I can do that. And we have better doctors down here. I'll get one to look at her. The family genes are, how shall I say it,
not too promising.
Thank you.
Yes, we tend to die young. And how is the lovely Stella?
Okay.
She didn't want to come back so soon, so she stayed in D.C. It's been a rough time. I'll say, what you folks need is some good luck.
Flory was back, shuffling along as her large tent of a dress flowed behind her. She was already happier being with Twyla in the big city. On an old wooden table that supposedly came from a farmhouse somewhere in France, a maid arranged a platter of raw oysters and poured cold wine. They ate and drank and laughed deep into the night. Once again, Ford County was in another world. Late the following morning, Joel stumbled from his bedroom with an aching head and dry mouth. He found water, quenched his thirst, and badly needed coffee. A maid quietly showed him the front door, and he stepped into the bright sunshine of another perfect day in the Via Carrée. He steadied himself, found his footing, and ambled down Charters to Jackson Square and his favorite little cafe, where the coffee was strong and half chicory. He drank one cup, paid for another to go, and walked across Decatur, through the French Market, and up the steps to the levee walk, where he sat on a bench. It was his favorite spot in the city, and he loved to loaf there for hours and watch the river traffic. At home in his late father's library, there was a picture book of New Orleans. In one photo from the 1870s, dozens of steamboats were docked side by side at the port, all laden with bales of cotton from the farms and plantations in Arkansas, Mississippi, and Louisiana. As a kid who daydreamed a lot, Joel had convinced himself that the cotton from the Banning farm was on one of those boats and had been shipped to New Orleans for export. Their cotton was important and needed by the world. The people who worked on the boats and docks made their livelihoods because of their cotton. Back then, the docks were rowdy and chaotic as steamboats swarmed in from upriver, and hundreds of stevedores scurried to unload them. That was all gone now. The great river was still busy, but the steamboats had been replaced by low, flat barges carrying grain and coal. In the distance were battleships resting from the war. Joel was captivated by the river and wondered where each vessel was headed. Some were going farther south, to the Gulf. Others were returning. He had no desire to go home. Home meant the last boring semester of law school. Home meant meetings with lawyers and judges and the winding up of his father's wretched affairs. Home meant saying farewell to the land, the house, to Nineveh and Amos, and the others he had known his entire life. He puttered around New Orleans for 3 days, and when he was finally bored, he hugged Flory goodbye and left town. She had settled in nicely and seemed to be quite at home. He drove to Biloxi and managed to surprise Marianne's father at his office. Joel apologized for the intrusion, but did not want her to know he was in town, and there was no other way to do it. He asked Mr. Maloof for his daughter's hand. Ambushed, the gentleman really had no choice but to say yes. That night, Joel had dinner with his soon-to-be fiancée and slept on the family's sofa. Chapter 49. The year 1950 began with as much dreariness as was expected. On January 26th, in John Wilbank's splendid conference room, he and Joel assumed one side of the table, while Birch Dunlap and Errol MacLeish took the other. Chancellor Chenault, without a robe, sat at the end and refereed the negotiations. Joel, as substitute executor, signed a deed that conveyed title to the 640 acres, with home, to Jackie Bell, now officially Jackie Bell MacLeish.
To avoid any misunderstandings with Florey, the land had been surveyed and platted so that the parties involved knew precisely where the property lines ran. All buildings had been identified, and a separate deed listed them. Stables, chicken sheds, tractor barns, cow barns, pig pens, the shotgun home of Nineveh and Amos, the foreman's house used by Buford Provine, and 14 shacks in the woods that were currently inhabited by the field hands. A bill of sale listed the personal property. Pete's 1946 Ford truck, the John Deere tractors, trailers, plows, planters, every piece of farm equipment down to rakes and shovels, along with the horses and livestock. MacLeish would get it all. He had allowed Joel to purchase the 1939 Pontiac for $300. Another document listed the furnishings in the house, what was left of them anyway. Joel had managed to take the books, keepsakes, guns, clothing, jewelry, memorabilia, bed linens, and better pieces of furniture. As far as cash, MacLeish didn't push too hard. He figured, rightfully so, that most of it had been either spent or hidden. Using the inventory Wilbanks had filed after probate in the fall of 1947, he agreed to accept the sum of $2,500, on behalf of his wife, of course. Joel had loathed the man for so long and so hard, it was difficult to conjure up another round of proper loathing. MacLeish was at once pompous and pathetic, as he considered sums of money and lists of assets earned and built by the sweat of others. He acted as though he truly believed that he and his new wife deserved the Bannings' land. The meeting was a nightmare, and at times Joel felt nauseated. As soon as possible, he left without a word, slammed the door behind him, and fled from the office. He drove to the farm and had tears in his eyes as he parked the car. Nineveh and Amos were sitting on the back porch, never the front, and they had the bewildered looks of people who might lose everything. They had been born on the Banning land and never left. When they saw the tears in Joel's eyes, they began crying too. Somehow the three managed to wade through the emotions and farewells and separate themselves. When Joel left them on the porch, Nineveh had collapsed into tears, and Amos was holding her. Joel walked to the barn, where Buford was waiting in the cold. Joel passed along the message from the new owner that he, MacLeish, would like to speak with Buford that afternoon. He would probably keep his job. Joel had said many fine things about their foreman, and it would be a mistake to replace him. Buford thanked him, shook his hand, wiped a tear of his own. Facing the raw wind, Joel walked half a mile over frozen soil to Old Sycamore and said goodbye to his parents. By a stroke of luck, the family cemetery was on Florey's section and thus accessible forever, or at least the near future. What did forever mean anymore? He was born to own his land forever. For a long time, he stared at both tombstones and asked himself for the thousandth time how their lives had become so complicated and so tragic. They were far too young to die and leave behind mysteries and burdens that would haunt those they loved. He looked at the other tombstones and wondered how many dark secrets the Bannings had taken all the way to their grave. He walked the field roads and pig trails and footpaths of the land for the last time. And when he returned to his car, his fingers were numb. He was chilled deep to the bone, and he ached to his core. Driving away, he refused to look at the house, and he wished he had burned it. Later in the afternoon, Errol MacLeish appeared at his new home and introduced himself to Nineveh. Neither tried to be polite. He didn't trust her because she had worked forever for the Bannings, and she thought of him as nothing more than a thieving trespasser.
"Would you like to keep your job?" he asked.
"Not really. I'm too old, sir. Too old for housework anymore. Ain't you got a bunch of kids?"
"There are three."
"See there, I'm too old to do all the washing and cleaning and cooking and ironing for three kids plus a wife. Me and Amos just need to retire. We too old."
"Retire where?"
"Can't we stay here? It's just a little house, but it's all we got. Been here over 50 years. Ain't worth nothing to nobody else."
"We'll see. I'm told Amos milks the cows and tends the vegetable garden."
"That's right. But he getting old, too."
"How old is he?"
"About 60, I guess."
"And you?"
"About the same."
"You got kids?"
"Bunch of them, but they all gone, up north. Just me and Amos in our little house."
"Where's Mr. Provine?"
"Buford? He down by the tractor barn, waiting."
MacLeish walked through the kitchen and across the porch. He tightened the scarf around his neck, lit a cigar, and strutted across the backyard, passing the barns and sheds, counting the livestock, savoring his good fortune. Jackie and the kids would arrive next week, and they would begin the wonderful challenge of establishing themselves as people to reckon with in Ford County. With his aunt tucked away safely in the warmth of New Orleans, and with his father's estate closed and his ancestral home now occupied by others, Joel had no reason to return to Ford County. Indeed, he wanted to stay away. Most of the cash left in the estate went to the Wilbanks firm for its faithful and loyal representation. His weekly telephone chats with John Wilbanks came to a halt, but not before the lawyer passed along the news that MacLeish had fired Nineveh and Amos and evicted them from their home. They had been given 48 hours to move and were currently living with relatives in Clanton. According to Buford Provine, who was gossiping with the Wilbanks' foreman on Florey's land, MacLeish was planning to charge the field hands rent on their shacks while at the same time cutting their wages. Joel was shocked and furious over the eviction. He could not imagine Nineveh and Amos living anywhere else or being forced to find a new home at their ages. He vowed to drive to Clanton, find them, and give them some money. And the other field hands were being abused for doing nothing wrong. They were accustomed to being treated fairly by his father and grandfather, but now an idiot was taking charge. Meanness does not inspire loyalty. The thought of it made him sick, and it was another reason to forget about the farm. If not for the magic of Marianne, he would have been a brooding, depressed 24-year-old law student facing a bleak future. She had said yes to his marriage proposal, and they were planning a small wedding in New Orleans after graduation in May. When spring arrived with all its promise and splendor, Joel shook off the doldrums and tried to savor his final days as a student. He and Marianne were inseparable. For spring break, they took the train to D.C. and spent a week with Stella. Along the way to D.C. and back, they spent hours talking of finding a better life far away from Mississippi. Joel wanted to run like his sister and bolt for the big cities up north where the opportunities seemed boundless and the memories more distant. Marianne was not quite as desperate to get away. But as the grandchild of immigrants, she was not opposed to the idea of starting over. They were just kids, madly in love, about to be married, so why not explore the world? On April 19th, Florey awoke in the early morning with aching chest pains. She was faint, could barely breathe, and managed to wake Twyla before collapsing in a chair. An ambulance took her to Mercy Hospital, where she was stabilized. Her doctors diagnosed it as a mild heart attack and were